integrity in each of the services is also critical to a strong military. General Amos, I have become friends with Major James Wyrick, United States Marine Corps, who I sincerely believe is a man of integrity. Did you fear Major Wyrick at any point?
My name is James Wyrick, and this is Military Justice, my podcast about the system of justice that governs those who protect our nation.
Some news just coming into the Situation Room about a Navy bribery scandal. Our Pentagon correspondent Barbara Starr has been working the story for us. Barbara, I understand there are some new charges.
New indictments by the Justice Department, Wolf, in an ever-widening Navy bribery scandal that's already been going on for years, dating all the way back 2012, 2013. Today, the Justice Department indicting another nine people, including a retired Navy admiral, over charges, allegations of bribery. This is the so-called Fat Leonard case, a nickname for a contractor out in Singapore who allegedly bribed Navy officials for years, trying to get lucrative Navy contracts in that area. There are allegations of multiple days long partying. Fat Leonard once picking up a $50,000 party bill for these Navy personnel, drinking women, prostitutes, some of it very unsavory, Wolf. How unsavory, you might ask? Well, let me read you just one sentence out of the Justice Department indictment. You may not want your children in the room for this one. The Justice Department saying, quote, during the party, referring to one party, historic memorabilia related to General Douglas MacArthur was used by the participants in sexual acts. This case has gone on a long time. The Navy certainly hopes this is the beginning of the end of the indictments.
This episode today is about the Navy scandal with Fat Leonard, and it's a kind of a continuation of episode 22, Misconduct at the Highest Ranks. In that episode, I mentioned that we would eventually get to high-ranking officer misconduct in the Navy, and that's taken a while because it's been rather voluminous as of late with the Fat Leonard scandal. And we are very lucky to have Mr. Whitlock here. He's a very fine reporter for the Washington Post, and he has been absolutely all over this story. Also, as we get closer to Bo Bergdahl's trial in October of 2017, I recently did an update on Crime Writers On. I've put a link to that show in the show notes, so please go there to hear my most recent thoughts on the Bo Bergdahl case. And also, at the end of this episode, at the end of the interview, I put up some audio that comes from Bloomberg. I didn't give you the entire audio because, of course, I didn't want to infringe on someone's intellectual property. But I did give you the first few minutes, and then I provided you a link in the show notes. You will notice that there's two commentators on that audio. One is Larry Morris. He's my old boss at one point, and the author of a book I've mentioned many times on this show. And also, Professor Rachel Van Landingham, you know her from this show many times. She's a law professor down in Southern California. So please enjoy their commentary on Bo Bergdahl, and believe me, I will be having more updates for you the closer we get to trial. I hope you enjoy today's interview. I surely did. Craig, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Before we go into the Fat Leonard case today, how did you get to the Washington Post?
A long and circuitous route. Well, actually, not that bad. I went to college at Duke, and I didn't study journalism. I studied history, but I worked full-time on the school paper. And after that, I worked for a small newspaper in Anniston, Alabama. And then I worked for several years as a reporter for the News and Observer in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I came to the Washington Post almost 20 years ago as a staff writer and stayed ever since.
So what did you cover in your 20 years?
Well, a little bit of everything.
Yeah, that's what government. I thought. Like, you haven't just been a national security or military guy, right?
No. In fact, when I came to the Post, I was on our Metro desk, where I did a lot of investigative work. And then I went overseas for several years on our foreign desk. I was based in Berlin, but I mostly covered counterterrorism issues in Europe and as well as North Africa and the Middle East. And that was a fantastic job. I got to do a lot of long-form, in-depth reporting and traveled all over the place. And it was a terrific 6 years on our foreign desk.
Oh, wow. That's great.
And then I came back to Washington to be one of our Pentagon correspondents. And about a year ago, I moved over to our investigative desk full time.
And I've mentioned on previous podcasts, I think there's probably you, Hope, Hodgsek, Tom Vandenbroek. Yeah. And you guys are all amongst the best of covering the military.
Well, thank you.
So tell me, how did you come across this? And listen, I don't know why we have to keep calling him Fat Leonard, the poor guy. I mean, I know he stole from the U.S. government, but can't we just call him Leonard?
Yeah, we can call him Leonard. That's what I think most people who knew him, just he was known as Leonard. He was kind of this first name basis. Everybody in the Pacific knew him as Leonard, right?
Right.
Not Leonard. It was sort of like in Washington, when you say Hillary, everybody knows who you mean. And in Westpac, if you mentioned Leonard, everybody knew who you meant.
Yeah, we wouldn't say Crooked Hillary or Lion Ted. Like, poor guy has been had the moniker Fat Leonard since the story broke.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's true, and it's probably not the most flattering nickname, but it was also one that's how he was known in the Navy, and he is kind of a big guy, and in fact, at one of his bail hearings, his lawyers were arguing for bail, and the Justice Department was opposed. They said, no, he's a criminal, he's likely to flee the country, he's going to go back to Singapore, or, you know, that he'll somehow let loose. And his attorneys argued, this guy, his name's Fat Leonard, he weighs 350 pounds, and his photo's been on the front page of papers all over the world. How far do you think he'll be able to get?
Yeah, that's...
And the judge was sympathetic, but they lost, and so he's been locked up in waiting sentencing ever since.
Yeah, have you traveled out to San Diego for any of the trials or any of the hearings?
I have not. There actually haven't been very many hearings because in this case, almost there hasn't been a single trial. Everybody has pleaded guilty so far or is contesting the case, but nobody's gone to trial. So there haven't been many hearings, and the hearings that have been held have been more, you know, procedural or very brief. There have been a lot of court records in the case, but not much has transpired live in court except for sentencings.
I'm going to play a little game right now, since I think you definitely are the expert in this case. I'm going to guess that we know of, we're about 300 individuals were involved?
Well, close. We know 200 plus.
Okay.
And the only reason we know that is, well, so let me back up a second. So the Justice Department has filed charges against about 25 people. Right, in federal civilian court. Now, the Justice Department, then there are a whole bunch of other people who they've investigated or have come under scrutiny, but they've said, well, maybe they did something that was unethical or they violated some rules, but maybe it wasn't a federal crime. And so they've turned those cases over to the Navy. And what they said is that they've turned over about 200 other cases to the Navy. So you have, you know, 25 cases that the Justice Department has handled, and they've turned over another 200. So you're talking, you know, at least 225. But beyond that, there hasn't been a public accounting of how many people have been swept up in this. You know, certainly that number could have grown. Since we heard that 200 figure from the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Diego, it's you know, it's been a year and a half. So certainly at least 225 people have been swept up in this.
I'm kind of assuming some knowledge on the part of the listeners, so I'll back up. So the Fat Leonard case is about the 7th Fleet operates, its area of operation is throughout the Pacific. And Fat Leonard ran a husbanding service. So when ships came into port, they need retrofit, they need supplies. And he would be the person that would do that at all these various ports. And he was bribing Navy officials to get advanced information about where the ships would be.
That's right. The name of his company is Glenn Defense Marine Asia. And Leonard's full name is Leonard Glenn Francis. He's a Malaysian citizen. He moved the headquarters to Singapore, but they had operations all throughout the Pacific, from Vladivostok down to Brisbane. Sometimes he was in India and all the way to the, you know, these little islands in the Western Pacific. So he grew this company, even though it dated back to the late 40s when his grandfather founded it. He really made it big on the back of the U.S. Navy by supplying their ships and subs, refueling them, pumping wastewater, giving them food, port security, anything they needed whenever they made port visits all over the Pacific.
Yeah, and I've talked to, I have some other surface warfare officer friends in the Navy, and they said both because of the geographic area that made the 7th Fleet more vulnerable, because the individual commanders and the individuals on ships have much more latitude. This isn't like the 5th Fleet operating in the Mediterranean. You know, that's a pretty small area. This area is massive. That's probably at least half the globe that he's operating in.
Well, that's right. It is half the globe. And, of course, the 7th Fleet is the biggest numbered fleet in the Navy. And not just the biggest numbered fleet, but, you know, most of the officer corps in the Navy, as they become senior officers, if you're going to rise through the ranks in the Navy at some point, you've at least done a tour or deployed or served in the 7th Fleet. This is, you know, just about every senior officer, flag officer in the Navy at some point was routed through this area.
Speaking of senior officers, how many have we had swept up in this?
Well, again, this is something where we don't have a precise number.
Yeah.
But the estimates, the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral John Richardson, has told senior Navy officials at various confabs they've had that about 30 flag officers, 30 admirals have been under investigation. We know that two recently retired admirals have been charged with crimes in federal court. One pleaded guilty, the other one's fighting it. We know that three admirals were censured by the Secretary of the Navy a couple years ago for taking gifts and going to some of Leonard's fancy parties. And at least one other admiral received non-judicial punishment. So we know the names of several, but the numbers who have actually been under investigation is quite a bit more.
Yeah, and I think that, as you mentioned, that everybody punches their ticket through the 7th Fleet at some point. And I think that's what's made this extraordinarily difficult for the Navy to try to fully crack down on, because it involves so many people.
Well, not just so many people, but as you pointed out, so many senior people and so many admirals who have and captains who went through 7th Fleet, and an awful lot of them, at a minimum, knew Leonard and were friendly with him. What's been harder to pin down is how many of them crossed the line into unethical or illegal conduct. But we know, you know, at least several admirals have who have been charged, who have been disciplined by the Navy. But, you know, Leonard had a real talent for, he's a very charismatic individual, but he had a real talent for rubbing elbows with senior officers and figuring out who was an up-and-comer, who would be helpful to him down the road. And he sort of had this, you know, incredible ability to ingratiate himself with the leaders of the Navy. When we did a story a little over a year ago, one of the striking things is the number of photographs there are of Leonard, these
grip
and grin photographs of Leonard with really a who's who in the U.S. Navy that he's accumulated over the years. Now, some of them may just be, you know, admirals all the time. They pose for pictures of people, and there's no you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But other ones he was pretty friendly with. And we'd hear stories about how Leonard would socialize and go to dinner and bring admirals in for parties or captains. And, you know, a lot of it was pretty over the top. So, you know, that's what's striking about this case is how long it went on, which was at least 20 years that we know of, that he was engaged in unethical conduct with officers in the Seventh Fleet. And how many people were involved? You know, at least 225 people, perhaps more. So the number of people who crossed the line with Leonard is pretty striking. But clearly there's an even bigger universe of people who certainly were aware of Leonard and the kind of stuff he did. You know, his reputation preceded him. People knew what kind of character this was, and yet he was able to avoid prosecution, avoid getting in trouble for year after year after year after year. He was very clever. He had a lot of moles. He ran circles around NCIS, the Naval Criminal Investigative Service. But what's amazing is how long he got away with this, even though so many people knew about it.
I think that's one of the problems the Navy's had with this, because so many people are involved. For example, and you've done a great job of covering this, the Admiral Twig Branch, aviator, he was the head of naval intelligence. And for, I want to say, almost his entire tour there, he did not hold a security clearance.
That's right. And we found that out in November of 2013, right before Thanksgiving, late on a Friday night, the Navy put out an announcement that Vice Admiral Branch and one of his deputies, a Rear Admiral Bruce Lovelace, who was later charged by the feds, had both had their security clearances suspended because they were under investigation. Now, you know, 3+ years later, we still know what the outcome of that investigation is with Admiral Branch. He's even retired, but for almost the entire time he was Chief of Naval Intelligence, he was in this bizarre situation where he was in charge of Navy intel, but he wasn't allowed to see any classified material or have any classified discussions. And, you know, it's sort of absurd to think that you could have a person in that job for that long. The Navy Secretary, Ray Mabus, at the time said he had to suspend him because his access to classified material, because he knew he was under investigation, but he thought an indictment was imminent, but an indictment still hasn't come, but he was left in this no man's land. But again, this is a 3-star admiral in charge of intelligence, and the question was he compromised by Leonard Francis? And Leonard got his hands on an awful lot of classified information, primarily about ship movements, but also about things like missile defense. More than 10 Navy officers have confessed to leaking him classified information. And again, remember, this guy's a foreign national. You know, there's not been another case like this in military history. We've had so many officers admitting to giving classified material, you know, U.S. secrets to a foreigner.
I spent a lot of my career in SCIFs, so secured classified buildings. So, I mean, just on a day-to-day basis, so Admiral Branch really can't even go in the front door. I mean, that's usually in those big areas, the SCIF, so the secured area is the entire building. I've been to it down in Suffolk. How can he do any of his job as the head of intel?
Well, he certainly can't do it effectively. Now, the Navy would say, oh, he's focused on budgets and personnel matters, and his deputies would take over. But, I mean, it was just this very, very awkward, to say the least, situation they were in for you know, almost 3 years. And finally he retired. And again, it's important to note that no charges have been brought against him. He's denied any wrongdoing, but
right,
this is a clear example of how you know, the Leonard Francis scandal, while it's attracted all sorts of attention for the hijinks he and the Navy officers were up to, but you know, it's had a profound impact on operations. And that's just one example. Another concrete example that affects more people is that so many people have been under investigation that, of course, while those investigations are pending, they can't get promoted, they can't take new jobs, really, that this has put a real freeze on, you know, dozens and dozens of Navy officials taking new jobs, taking new positions, and it's really gummed up the personnel works in the senior ranks. And we've seen no sign that that's slowing down. Almost 4 years into this case, you know, it's been almost 4 years since Leonard Francis was arrested in a sting operation in San Diego. And every several months, it appears, the case keeps escalating.
Yeah, and with the Branch case, and I just focus on this because I've been involved in things like this. If you have Marines who could no longer retain a security clearance, they're separated. You know, if their job requires that and they can't keep a security clearance, they're going to be fired from the Marine Corps. And it seems like we just kind of had Branch treading water there for a few years.
What is striking with the Fat Leonard case is that how little the Navy has been willing to divulge about its investigations under UCMJ. The Justice Department, you know, it's in the public record every time they indict or charge somebody, but the Navy has been very unwilling to reveal the outcomes of its disciplinary investigations. There's been one case that looks like it's going to court-martial, and that was just recently resulted in charges being filed down in Norfolk by the Navy. But again, there's a couple hundred other people who have been investigated by the Navy, and we don't know the outcomes. We don't know how many of them were cleared. We don't know how many of them received non-judicial punishment. We don't know how many received reprimands, or, you know, how many were just separated. The Navy's clammed up about the whole thing. Clearly, they're embarrassed by the extent of this, and they don't like any of the attention, and they've been trying very hard to keep it quiet.
Yeah, is that a commander or a captain down in Norfolk that's being charged?
A commander, I believe.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, the Navy's being very disingenuous, in my opinion, the way they're even handling that. They brought out the charge sheet and didn't even make his name available on it.
Yeah, not till the moment when his first hearing started. I mean, it is sort of preposterous. I mean, I had heard rumors for weeks that they had charged him and others, but they refused to release it. Finally, they admitted that they had charged somebody, and they released a charge sheet with his name blacked out. And they said they wouldn't put his name out until he actually appeared in a courtroom. So they finally did, but it was just the lengths to which they go to hide and conceal who's under investigation and what's happened are sort of preposterous. There's certainly the Navy would defend it, saying they're protecting the privacy rights of those involved. But the bigger question here is accountability. You know, to what degree is the Navy going to go to hold its own people accountable? And given the number of senior people who are under scrutiny, it's certainly a legitimate question: is the Navy able to hold itself accountable in by what all measures is perhaps the biggest ethics scandal in its history?
Yeah, and I think that's really telling, that blacking out of the name, because the Navy could have just withheld any information until they go to trial. You know, they have the first hearing. But to black out the name, you're just trying to hold off for like one more day, or, you know, maybe don't say his name until the end of the court hearing that day. You know, you call him, you know, Commander X. But I think
this is, you know, an example. This is like what they do with, you know, spy cases almost. That's the level of secrecy. But what's striking is the Navy historically has been proud of how it has announced to the public when commanding officers are relieved or suspended for various reasons, whether it's they screw up or personal misconduct. But the Navy's very open when a commanding officer of a ship or a sub is sacked or relieved. You know, they announce it, and they'll briefly what happened, and they make a point of saying, we need public accountability. These are officers with enormous responsibility on their shoulders, and, you know, when we screw up, we hold them accountable. We hold them publicly accountable. As opposed to the Army or the Air Force, which tends to not disclose that sort of thing.
Yeah, and the Marine Corps is not as good either. We usually just go with loss of confidence.
Right, but, you know, the Navy is, you know, usually if they relieve a commanding officer, they'll disclose it. They'll proactively disclose it. But in the Leonard Francis case, they're bending over backwards not to disclose when people get in trouble or are disciplined or charged or, you know, suspended. I mean, it's just been the complete opposite of the Navy's tradition of public accountability.
Yeah, especially the idea of there's a point at which you are, if you're senior enough, maybe at the two-star, three-star, or definitely two-, three-, and four-star ranks, where the privacy rights are really minimal given the public's need to know about these senior officials and their conduct.
Well, I've had this argument for a couple of years with the Navy. Their own regulations, their own, they call it JAGMAN regulations, the Judge Advocate General Manual regulations, state that it should be public information anytime there's adverse action or adverse information involving an admiral, a flag officer. But they've been ignoring their own regulations when it comes to the flag officers getting in trouble in the Fat Leonard case. Sometimes they'll disclose it, but not always.
Well, I think that to a certain extent, if you look at Rear Admiral Kraft, Rear Admiral Pimpo, Miller, they were really had been held after their proposed retirement dates, and then they get a letter of reprimand that goes into their file, and then they retire. That letter means nothing.
Certainly for Admiral Vice Admiral Miller, who was the superintendent at the Naval Academy, he's, again, a very prestigious job in the Navy, he was ready to retire, and they held up his retirement, and he got the letter of censure. So you're right, that didn't really have any effect. The other two admirals were not planning to retire. In fact, I think certainly Admiral Kraft, he was in charge of U.S. Forces Japan, and I think they were expected to keep rising through the ranks. So that did cut short their careers. But, you know, again, the difference there is at least the Navy announced that they had been censured.
Right.
Whereas there's other ones, they won't say boo about it.
And we had that, you know, skipping over to a different service, you had that with General Custer and General Dempsey, where they didn't, when General Dempsey, later to become the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, previously his two-star subordinate, he disapproved all the findings of his misconduct. And we would have never known about that but for a FOIA request.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that is the case with the Army and the Air Force. In the vast majority of cases, if generals in those services get in trouble, the Army and Air Force don't disclose it. It's up to journalists or others to file FOIA requests, which they sit on for months before they disclose it. There was a case recently I wrote about involving the general in charge of Fort Riley out in Kansas, the 1st Infantry Division, and the Army there, they did announce that he had been suspended, but they wouldn't say why. And it took, that was last September. It took till May when they were ignoring FOIA requests. But I finally had somebody tip me off that the general there, General Grigsby, Major General Grigsby, had been fired, he had been investigated and complaints upheld about him carrying on inappropriate relationship with a young female officer and the impact this had on the 2nd Infantry Division preparing to go to Iraq. So it was a very serious case, but, you know, it was just pulling teeth to get the Army to divulge any information about it.
If I recall, I think there was maybe a bill introduced a few sessions ago in Congress that would have made any general officer misconduct a matter of public record, or, you know, that it wouldn't have to go through the FOIA process.
Yeah, unfortunately, that hasn't caught on fire yet. But, I mean, it certainly, there are people in Congress who are frustrated by it, but the services and the inspectors general, they don't, you know, it's kind of crazy, but they don't want people to know. They don't want to have to proactively notify people about this stuff. It's something that's been getting more attention from some journalists who've gotten better about filing these FOIA requests and pressing the services for more answers and responsiveness. But boy, it's still pulling teeth to find out.
I'll tell you, you know, there's some debate about new media, old media, traditional media, those type of things. But for these type of issues, traditional media, like the reporting you've been doing, is so important. But it takes a lot to have, you know, a credible threat of a lawsuit and doing all that time with FOIA requests, because if you guys weren't doing this, we would know none of this.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's true. And, you know, anybody, any citizen can file, you know, you don't have to be a citizen. You can be a foreigner to file a FOIA request with U.S. government. But there are some agencies that are good about it, and they try and follow the law and the timetables for responding. But, you know, other parts of bureaucracy, if they want to delay it, they know how to sit on it and sit on it and sit on it. Even then, when you have journalists who are experienced in dealing with those kind of cases, you know, it's a real slog to force them to cough up what they acknowledge are public records. You know, if it involves a general officer, a flag officer, you know, all the services admit that if they get in trouble, they're supposed to disclose it, and it's supposed to be a public record. But, you know, it's just, it can be such a fight to force them to follow the law. And again, that's the sort of irony here is, you know, the services, the U.S. military is all about, you know, protecting our freedoms and following the law. And they're so good about that in so many ways. But in some cases like this, when it comes to protecting reputations of people who got in trouble, they flout the law when it comes to public records.
Yeah, that really is too bad. I've dealt with that. I've filed FOIA requests in the past. But I think that having the Washington Post behind you has got to help to a certain extent, because I know that the individual filing a FOIA request, they're just like, it just languishes.
Well, it can for us, too. We don't have any additional standing, except you're right. I mean, sort of the threat of filing a lawsuit, or I think which is perhaps more effective, is writing about it.
Right.
Saying that if the Army or the Navy waited 6 months or a year to respond to a FOIA request, if we say, look, we're going to tell the public about that, and, you know, you can comment, but, you know, people are going to draw their own conclusions what's going on. I mean, there really is no excuse to take so long to respond to specific FOIA requests. And, you know, sometimes that helps, but, you know, other times, you know, they still take months or years to get around to it. And it's a shame, because some of these cases, like you said, in Congress, some members of Congress have said, why do they even have to file a FOIA request? These are clearly public records. If an inspector general has substantiated allegations, meaning they've found credible evidence that somebody has violated the law, that's undoubtedly a public record. It should just be released upon request or automatically disclosed when the investigation's done. Why are we covering these up? And I haven't heard a good response as to why that can't be the case. Usually, you know, if it's public information, these agencies, the services, shouldn't get to hide behind FOIA as a way to delay it. That really just gives them the tool to sit on it for a long time. These should be public records. It's public information. The people of the country have a right to know when there's misconduct by senior officials. But again, it's been a real battle to get that information out.
Yeah, like if you want the court records for, like, Fat Leonard, his actual court records, you just go on to Pacer. They're freely available. I mean, you can have a free account.
Right, or you can, you know, but again, there's been a long, long tradition, and you go to the courthouse, right? You know,
right.
Courthouse, the records are presumed open unless a judge seals it for some reason, which can happen. But you're right, the Justice Department, the courts have always operated under the presumption that what they do should be public information. Unfortunately, these other cases, I think we're still in a long-term process of educating the services that there's a reason this should be public information and that it should be available upon request.
Right. Like, for example, if the public was aware that General Dempsey had disapproved all of the findings against General Custer, and that would have been before his hearing to become the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, that would have been information that was probably pretty important, because I remember when General Dempsey was there, I think all the services had kind of been rocked by some senior officer misconduct. And Dempsey, you know, a number of times either sent out memos or made proclamations about how, you know, everyone's going to get tougher on senior officer misconduct.
I remember that vividly, because when General Dempsey was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, I was writing about a lot of cases involving General Petraeus, General Allen. There's a four-star commander of Africa Command who got in trouble. And
Kip Ward,
there were a whole bunch of cases that were front-page news. And Dempsey was sort of forced to respond to this. He would send a memo to first Secretary Panetta, then Secretary Hagel, saying, well, you know, we take this very seriously, and here's what we're going to do about it. But he never made a disclosure of how he handled cases like General Custer. And that was, you know, USA Today, Tom Vandenbroek was the one, I think, who disclosed that case after the fact.
Yeah, he did a good job on that.
But that was one that slips through the cracks of our requests. Usually when we file FOIA requests, I'll go to an agency or one of the services every so many months, file it under FOIA, just asking. I want all reports by your inspector general that substantiated misconduct against senior officials, right? It's a very specific, clear definition of what records they have to cough up. But what we don't find out are the ones where they didn't substantiate it, or like in that case where they did, but then Dempsey overruled it. You know, it's just, they have all sorts of ways to fall through the cracks. It's a sort of catch-22. If you don't know the case exists, it's hard to ask for it. So you make these blanket requests that say anybody that would meet this definition, you have to, you know, we're requesting it. But sometimes it's not an inspector general that did the investigation. Sometimes it's a commander-directed investigation, or sometimes it's, you know, the Army has these what they call 15-6 investigations, or it's some other thing that somebody got in trouble, but they have all sorts of ways to do it that you have to sort of think creatively to ask for records that would fall in that category. And the General Custer was one that, you know, if USA Today hadn't, I think, gotten a tip about it and knew to ask for it specifically, it would have never seen the light of day.
Right, because, so correct me if I have this wrong, but the Army Inspector General makes a number of findings about his misconduct, I think, with a younger female. And then he is a subordinate command at the time to General Dempsey, who was a three-star at TRADOC, which is the training and operations that they do all the doctrine for the Army, how the Army's going to fight wars. So he's the superior general. So the Inspector General sends up an investigation saying, we've made these three findings against General Custer. General Dempsey says, I don't believe any of that. I disapprove these three findings. And then, so if you're asking them any substantiated misconduct by senior officers, they could, you know, kind of say, well, this wasn't substantiated because the commanding general disapproved it.
Yeah, right. And exactly. And there's some real gray area with that. I mean, you right. could certainly argue that it was substantiated by the IG, but
oh yeah.
But they find, again, they find ways that these cases fall through the cracks. I mean, it's been a few times I've asked the Department of Defense Inspector General for cases, and to their credit, they've gotten better about it than they were a few years ago.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, you know, but they would come back and say, "Oh, here's one that we forgot about that happened a couple years ago, right?" Or you know, it's just like they materialize out of nowhere, and you're like, "Wait a second, how does that work?" So it's very easy to hide these things in the bureaucracy unless you make a very, very specific request. And I mean, I'm reporting now on a case involving the Air Force, and I had filed a FOIA back in November about, I don't want to reveal too much because I haven't published a story yet, but you know, I
go ahead, break it right now. I'm happy.
I heard there was an Air Force Inspector General report on this one guy in one place, and I asked for it, and they responded, oh, nothing of that type exists, right? Well, more recently, I found out, in fact, there is one, and I just had to, you know, scream and say, you guys lied about this. You know, you have to, I know, here's a reference to it in another document. And then they say, oh, well, we didn't know you were asking, you know, they give you some ridiculous response for why they couldn't find it in the first place, but I mean, it's very difficult. You have to ask very, very specifically for something. But if you're just trying to find in general who's been getting in trouble, it's, you know, again, it's needle in a haystack, and they really drag it out.
Yeah. I mean, if we take the federal court PACER model, and so just for people that don't know, PACER is an electronic database that has probably 99%, anything that's not sealed by a protective order of a judge, you can just go on Pacer and browse and just look up in any federal district court what's going on. And that's free to the public. I mean, it's, I think they've done a very good job of that. And that should be, I mean, if you look at the executive branch, the DOD is by far the largest, you know, as far as funds and personnel. So we have, what are we, maybe six, 700 admirals and generals at any one time?
Well, 900 general and flag officers at any one time.
Man, the Marine Corps is small. We only have 64. Wow.
Yeah, well.
And they get in some trouble too. But so 900, so you have 900 people that are, you know, in charge of the lives of our young men and women, in charge of the largest amount of our federal budget, and then you're not able to track what they do or how they do it.
Well, I think the problem is even larger than that. The whole military justice system, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, if let's say for argument I got arrested in Georgia for DWI, right? You know, right. That's going to be public record if it's in the civilian courts. But if you're in the military and you get arrested for something similar, and you know, it's very difficult to find out. There's no central repository of records. There's no databases that the public can access. I mean, let alone people getting in disciplinary trouble. I'm talking about people got court-martialed or got convicted of military crimes. You can file a FOIA that may or may not get a response, but you know, you can't just go to some courthouse and find out who's been convicted of crimes under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It's a very decentralized system, but it's very non-transparent to the public in terms of who's been convicted. If you know, just you happen to know somebody was court-martialed, you can then ask and you can FOIA for the record of court-martial, but you have to know where, you have to know when, you have to, and even then it can take months to get a response. But if you just, if you wanted to do records checks on people, it's a very difficult thing to do if you're a member of the public.
Going back, geez, 15 years ago now, when I was working at the Navy Yard, I had made a proposal to the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces to have them go electronic with the PACER system. And PACER is operated by the federal courts. And, I mean, the fee was like $1,500 to set this up for all of the military so that if it was, you know, a federal crime and civilian or military, it's the same level of transparency. And they just never had any, I don't know, that they just didn't have any desire to even think about it. I don't know. No. I mean, it was, I don't want to say that they were against it, but they just, it was complete apathy. Like, what are you talking about? You know, and in fairness, I was maybe a captain or a major at the time. So they're just looking at me like, hey, could you just go away?
Well, but I think that's right. They want you to go away because it's an uncomfortable question that they don't really have a good answer for. And it wouldn't be that hard. A lot of the, you know, the services have their own JAG databases on cases. And, you know, but again, it's this presumption that everything should be private. But the irony here is in the civilian world, those records are almost always public. But when it comes to the military, they don't want to. I mean, it's like with court martials, one problem that journalists have in covering them is they don't know when they happen, right? It's right. It's only if they the service happens to mention or post something somewhere in some obscure website that there's a case coming up and somebody asks about it. But even then, to report on a court martial, you have to physically be present. They won't release any information while a trial is going on about the outcome or testimony or charges. You have to be present. And of course, for civilians to show up in a military courtroom isn't easy either, right? You can't just stroll onto a post or a base and say, "Where, you know, here's the courthouse." You
right.
Have to,
they're almost always in the middle of a base. And right. If you show up at the front gate and there's that young guard, and in fairness to the guard, he's like, "Well, why am I letting you on here? Oh, I want to go and just watch this court martial."
Yeah, right. Yeah, they think you're nuts. And And you do have to be a little nuts to push to see these things. But anyway, it's just, my point is they don't make it transparent. They could, but they don't. And you can certainly come to your own conclusions as to why that is.
Well, I'll tell you, a friend of mine, James Laporta, I think he's done some work for you at the Washington Post, but I think he writes for the Daily Beast mostly right now, but he's had his access. I mean, he's a retired Marine. He had his access to Paris Island suspended because he's been reporting on cases.
Yeah, I saw that, and that's terrible. It sends a really bad message, but it's too bad because I think giving access and disclosing information, the point isn't to embarrass or rub people's noses in it. It's to have a measure of public accountability. And I think institutions are strengthened when they aren't afraid of that, when they say, look, you know, it's our whole reason to exist is to serve the public. The public grants us extraordinary authority and power and spends a lot of money on us, and they deserve to know when we succeed, and they deserve to know when sometimes we or individuals fail. And only by being transparent does that breed trust that we handle things properly. And the converse to that, of course, is when things are not disclosed, when they're swept under the rug, that's when people start to lose confidence in institutions like this.
Yeah, and I think it also has a prophylactic effect. For example, in, you know, discouraging misconduct at all. Because to circle back to the Fat Leonard case, I mean, can you give us some idea of what kind of bribery was going on? What kind of parties are we talking about? That sort of thing.
Yeah, well, it kind of blows your mind the kind of parties we're talking about. And I mean, just one example, recently there was an indictment that came out of the Department of Justice out of civilian court in San Diego, I think it was back in April, and it targeted something like 7 or 8 former officers with the 7th Fleet. And it would talk about the parties Leonard would throw for officers on the Blue Ridge, which is the flagship of the 7th Fleet. So not just any warship, but the flagship of the 7th Fleet. You know, the commander of the 7th Fleet and the, you know, captains and others who were really running operations for the whole 7th Fleet. And for a period of time, anytime the Blue Ridge would pull into port, whether it was Singapore or Hong Kong or Manila or Japan, it was Leonard would just follow it around and throw these wild parties. And by wild parties, I mean, he would just go over the top. You know, he'd throw these dinner parties at these 5-star restaurants where he'd spend over $1,000 a head, which is, I mean, I'm not a gourmand, but I have a hard time even imagining how you could order $1,000 worth of stuff at a dinner. But he would get Cristal champagne, Dom Perignon. He'd get these Cohiba cigars from Cuba with, you know, 10 courses. And he'd, you know, and that's just the food and drink. But then he'd take them to a nightclub and he'd have these, he'd not just have prostitutes, but he'd fly in hookers from other countries, right? He had to have the highest class prostitutes at these parties. And he did this for years and years and years. This was his, if you look at the records on all these different parties he threw, he really adhered to a pretty striking formula. He would just have these over-the-top meals at these unbelievably expensive restaurants in Hong Kong and Singapore and all over the place. And he'd bring in, then he'd take them all out for what he called the after party, which is where the hookers came in. And some of these, there was one party in Manila that lasted for 72 hours while the Blue Ridge was in port. And the court records include these emails from the Navy captain saying, that was the most unbelievable time I've had since college. You know, I'm still sobering up. You know, thanks for the hookers. And they would even send Leonard photos of them with the hookers, right? And which is not only unbelievable, but then that's federal evidence, right? Once the prosecutors get their hands on that stuff, it makes it very difficult to defend yourself in court when you've sent emails of yourself with hookers saying thank you to Leonard Francis for providing it. You know, it makes it tough to plead your case. So, but again, this went on for at least 20 years, which is just, you know, mind-boggling to think about.
Yeah, that's I have some firsthand experience with this. When I was the SJA for McSiddick, so the three-star SJA down at Quantico, we had a triple homicide or a murder-suicide, a love triangle that ended in everybody being dead. And so NCIS had been looking into this, and it was, you know, we needed to kind of spur them along to get the conclusion of it. And I just drove down to the NCIS office one day and said, hey, you know, can I talk to the senior special agent in charge, and who I had been briefed by and knew fairly well, and it's John Bellevoix, who did exactly that. I mean, there's numerous emails and asking for, hey, make sure, you know, that I get two prostitutes, you know. I was absolutely stunned. It was really the brazenness of it. He's using, you know, texts and emails to talk about, you know, I wasn't really happy about the prostitute quality last time. Let's step it up or something.
Well, and you're right. And so you put your finger on something particular about the Leonard Francis case. It wasn't just that he was taking to people to parties and hookers, but he had people on his payroll. And John Bellevoux, who was a senior supervisory agent for the NCIS, was on his payroll and not just took hookers, but he would take cash. He took cash money from Leonard. And in exchange, he gave Leonard all the NCIS case files that of investigations into Leonard's company. So NCIS had conducted at least two dozen separate criminal inquiries into Leonard's company over the years, and those cases went nowhere. And one of the reasons is that Bellevoux, for a number of years, was feeding all those case files and notes from his fellow NCIS agents. He'd stick them on CDs or he'd transfer them, he'd mail them to Leonard. So Leonard knew exactly who was being interviewed. He knew what they knew. He knew what they didn't know. And this helped him avoid getting caught for years. But it was the worst mole in the history of NCIS and completely compromised their investigations up until the fall of 2013 when Leonard was finally caught. But Leonard was so cocky, he was so convinced that he could get away with anything, that he had this NCIS agent and many other Navy officers on his payroll, that he would openly brag in emails that he, you know, somebody would tip him off and say, oh, NCIS is doing this or Justice Department is looking at you for that. And he would just scoff and say, yeah, don't worry, bro. It's all under control. They're all bought and paid for, right? And for years, that's how it worked until finally he did get his comeuppance. But the extent to which he had penetrated the Navy, its investigative apparatus, penetrated the contracting agencies, penetrated operations on the Blue Ridge, it's really astounding the degree to which he was able to get his moles, his people, people on the payroll who served the U.S. Navy and how many of them there were and the information they would give him for years and years and years. And I think there certainly hasn't ever been a case like that, and certainly hope there's not another one again.
Well, and I think that's why it's so important that, you know, we've kind of been harping on this, but that the Navy's kind of reticence to make this public, that only makes the next occurrence of this more likely, because they feel that kind of insulation from ever being caught. And I worked with Bellevoux. I liked him. You know, I'd had lunch with him. He was working on an important case, you know, for my general. I never would have suspected that. I mean, I had, you know, no clue about any of that. But I think that knowing that the institution will try to keep it as secret as possible fosters this.
Well, I think you're right. Where's the deterrent effect? But also, you know, I don't think it's going to be tough to get a full understanding of how long this went on, how deep it went, how far up it went. You know, the Justice Department, their job is to, you know, if there's a federal crime, they're supposed to prosecute and hold somebody accountable. You know, and they're good at getting guilty pleas, but, you know, if there is no trial, a lot of this material is never going to come to light. Their job is to get convictions. But what we haven't seen the Navy have any interest in so far is doing some sort of accountability investigation, some sort of deep dive that rather than investigating individuals or trying to prosecute individuals, but some sort of commission or some senior person who's just supposed to say, okay, we need you to explain not just to us, but to the American public, exactly what happened here. Sort of like almost a mini 911 report or something, or a Kennedy commission, to somebody to say, okay, beyond prosecuting, beyond the crimes, we need to, you know, a deep dive here, lessons learned, what happened and how do we prevent it from happening again? And we really haven't seen that on any substantive level from the Navy.
No, I think you're exactly right that either a congressional committee or some outside agency just to give us a rundown of this, we the people, and then suggestions for how do we keep this from happening again, you know, and not just treat it as, well, we have 225 one-offs, you know, who happened to be bad seeds. There was something institutional that allowed that many people to get brought up into this. This is not, you know, there's always, you know, one half of 1% that, you know, of the military that's just bad and they'll get in trouble. But this scandal shows that even otherwise good people can be kind of brought into this if the institution doesn't have the right watchdogs.
Well, and you make a good point about Congress. They've been asleep at the switch on this. There, a few years ago, the House Government Oversight Committee said they would investigate and made a big show of it, but they never did anything. They just asked the Navy for a briefing, and there was nothing, no hearings, anything like that. I think members of Congress would say, well, they don't want to get involved as long as the Justice Department is investigating. They don't want to interfere. But this has been going on for almost 4 years, and there really has been no oversight or accountability from a public perspective from Congress. And, you know, certainly there's got to be ways they could do that without interfering with criminal proceedings. But they haven't shown any inclination to want to do that. I mean, there hasn't even been a single hearing on this. And I think that says something.
And not to pound the Navy too much, but you saw the Navy recently do that end run around the promotion of that retiring SEAL.
Right. That's another case. I mean, unrelated to the Leonard case. But,
right.
But you're right. I think that's another example of the Navy certainly going out of its way to stand up for favored senior officers, even to the point where, you know, in that case, they were willing to circumvent the will of Congress.
Yeah, Congress had denied, well, for the listeners, Congress had denied his promotion because there's been some substantiated misconduct in his case. And then, so I think the Navy withdraws his package from the Senate, and it didn't go through a confirmation hearing, or didn't have a confirmation. And then he sent over to the Navy Yard, and then within a month or so, he's filed this grievance to then get retroactively promoted. And the speed at which they did that was incredible to me.
It was just most people, if this was the Board of Correction of Naval Records for people who have retired. And normally, if you need to correct your military record, it will take at least a year. But in this case, it took a few weeks after the admiral retired. It clearly seemed like the fix had been in. This was part of an agreement that they would grant him his promotion to a 2-star admiral, even though Congress had said they didn't want it.
Craig, you have anything else you want to talk about?
No, it was enjoyable. I appreciate you having me on.
Hey, where can listeners follow you?
I'm on Twitter at Craig M. Whitlock. And, you know, just read the Washington Post. You'll see our stuff.
Thank you very much for being here.
There have been questions about why Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl left his post in Afghanistan in the middle of the night for more than 8 years. We may get some more answers after his military trial on charges of desertion and misbehavior before the enemy in late October. Bergdahl basically admitted to walking off his post on the podcast Serial.
20 minutes out, I'm going, good grief, I'm in over my head. Suddenly, you know, it really starts to sink in that I really did something bad.
He was captured by the Taliban shortly after and held for 5 years until he was freed in 2014 in an exchange for five Taliban prisoners. Bergdahl has chosen to be tried by a military judge rather than a military jury, a critical decision in this case where he faces a maximum sentence of life in prison. Our guests are Lawrence Morris, general counsel at Catholic University. He's a retired Army colonel who was a judge advocate. And Rachel Van Landingham, a professor at Southwestern Law School. She's a retired Air Force lieutenant colonel who was a judge advocate. Larry, let's start with the charges against Bergdahl. Defense attorneys lost a motion to have the charge of misbehavior before the enemy thrown out. Explain these charges.
The charge of misbehavior is a charge that, of course, only applies in wartime. And the way it applies here is, you know, the prosecution's argument would be that the law that says any soldier, any service member before the enemy who runs away or abandons his post and, by the words of the law, endangers the safety of his unit by that act, by that disobedience or that neglect or that misconduct, is then eligible to be punished separate from, you know, what we normally talk about as desertion, which is a similar charge for quitting your unit.
Military Justice is a production of Long Arc Digital Media. There are numerous people that need to be thanked for making Military Justice possible. First of all, audio. Those are the people that clean up all the mistakes I made. Hannah McCarthy. She takes care of that. Methil Talhan, she takes care of everything. She keeps the show moving along and keeps all of us on schedule. And as always, Uber producer Dreadnought has my six.